In anything larger than that, anything beyond the more immediate everyday situations than that, it was not assumed that physical laws existed, and that meant that the universe was a horribly frightening place because it was unpredictable. And it could get you no matter what you did. And you never knew when it was going to get you because it was unpredictable. The notion that physical laws exist and that the universe is therefore in principle understandable and therefore in principle controllable was one of the most liberating ideas in human consciousness when it finally came in. And where it came in, not where it was first introduced by somebody who said, gee, maybe it's so, but where it really began to look as though it were so, was at the time of probably the greatest physicist who ever lived, even more than Einstein, whom we're celebrating tonight. He'd be number two. The greatest of them was Sir Isaac Newton. Newton made so many discoveries of physical laws which turned out to work in the sense that they really did predict other phenomena that Newton hadn't specifically applied them to when he developed them, that all of a sudden it began to look as though, in fact, even though Newton had not explained everything, had explained, in fact, only some of the simplest phenomena, that is, simple elementary physics, billiard balls colliding with one another, planets orbiting other planets, that kind of thing, or planets orbiting stars, that kind of thing. He hadn't even touched things like human psychology, for example, which is a much, much more difficult system. Nevertheless, he had explained so much that for the first time in history, it began to look as though, in fact, the whole universe proceeded according to laws which we could understand, and therefore someday we could control all of these frightening phenomena that were out there in that, until then, seemingly unpredictable universe. And it was just a glorious, liberating experience to live in the generation, it must have been, to live in the generation which first began to feel that way. Such a tremendous fear to be lifted off of your back for the first time in history. And it did indeed have an enormous impact on fields far beyond the narrow regions of physics, which were of interest only to a relatively small number of specialists. And you can see it in the art of the time. Perhaps the best known example is the couplet by Pope. Nature and nature's laws lay hid in night. God said, let Newton be, and all was light. That's the effect that it had on them at that time. Halley, Sir Edmund Halley, the one who's so famous because of the comet. He's a lot of other things, but here's why he's famous because of the comet. Halley applied Newton's laws of gravitation, specifically, to the phenomenon of comets, which had been objects of terror, objects of, we would say, superstitious terror, which simply means they were believed not to be understandable, not to behave according to any laws that could be understood. He applied them to comets. He found, as he looked through history, that there had been a bright comet in the sky about every 75 years for a long time. He calculated the orbit of this body on the assumption that this was the same comet simply coming round and round and round again. And he predicted the next return, and it happened. And there up in the sky was something that was not an unpredictable, unknowable celestial apparition. It was something that Edmund Halley had said was going to be there because Newton's very simple law of gravitation led to that prediction. Halley was dead by the time the comet came back. But it made such an impression on people when it did that if you go and you see Halley's gravestone, it doesn't say, here are all the great things that he did in astronomy. It mentioned only one thing. And basically what it says, I don't know the exact words, but basically what it said is, this is the guy that predicted the comet. And to this day, Halley's comet is the most famous, not because it's the brightest, not because it's the best. There have been many comets in this century alone that have been better than Halley's comet was in its last apparition in 1910. And the next time around, 1985, 86, is going to disappoint people by the millions. It's never going to be more than barely visible to the naked eye. But that's not, there are bright comets all the time, though. But that's not important. The reason everybody remembers Halley's comet is it was the one, the prediction for which removed the terror. And you can see examples of this, as I said, way beyond the regions of physics at the time. the Declaration of Independence with this almost Euclidean, axiomatic presentation of the way things are versus the way things ought to be. The system of checks and balances in the U.S. Constitution is a Newtonian system. It's a mechanical arrangement. You press this button and it comes out here, and to prevent it from running away too much, you got this button over here which can be pressed and it prevents it from coming out here. That's a Newtonian system. It's something that would have been unthinkable before Newton came along and said, the universe works this way. And so then people said, perhaps this was a reasonable extrapolation and perhaps not, but it was such a wonderful idea that they were bound to say it, okay, human affairs can work the same way. Well, that is what an explanation means then in science, fitting it into one of these physical laws. Let it be pointed out that there is no way of proving or disproving the statement that all phenomena obey physical laws that can be observed. You could claim that there are things that do not, which are in fact unpredictable and therefore unstudiable by the methods of science. The problem is, if you're going to make such a prediction, how are you going to prove it? If you're going to make such a statement, rather, how are you going to prove it? If by definition the thing can't be studied, then how can you study it and thereby prove that it exists, you see? So we have no evidence that there are phenomena which do not proceed according to laws, but likewise, it is only an assumption that all phenomena do. Certainly a lot of them do, though. I repeat, it was that assumption which introduced only 3 centuries ago, took off human control of the universe from essentially zero, as it had been for 2 million years or more of human existence, and in just those few centuries has gotten us up to the point where we're going to the moon, we're air conditioning our buildings, and if that isn't control over nature, I don't know what it is. You know, all the technological things that we can do, in this century alone, in this country, human life expectancy has been more than doubled as a result of the application of the assumption that things proceed according to laws that can be found out to medicine. Human life expectancy has gone from 35 years, which seems to be the natural number, not the biblical 4 score and 10 at all. It was 35 years in caveman days, it was 35 years in Roman times, and it was 35 years in this country at the turn of the century. And it has gone up to 70 years already, still climbing. All as a result of Newton and his physics and other people applying it to places where they had no reason to assume it could be applied, but it turned out it worked. So if I try to tell you the reason why the Lorentz-Fitzgerald contraction occurs and the reason why the time dilation occurs, you will understand that all that I'm really doing is not giving you an explanation, but simply fitting them into a somewhat larger framework, giving you a somewhat deeper level of description, which is all that science, and I would argue all that anything else, any other branch of knowledge, if there are branches of knowledge other than science, is about. The reason why, in that sense, they both happen, is to make the speed of light constant. Einstein was the one who realized that, and what Einstein realized, and subsequent experiments have confirmed, is that the speed of light is the same number as measured by all observers, independent of their motion relative to one another. Now, that statement is the way the physics books always put it, and the universal reaction to that is, well, of course. I mean, why shouldn't the speed of light be a constant? Because you are so used to living in a non-Einsteinian universe, so far as you can tell, you're so used to living in speeds that are exclusively low compared to that of light, that your mind automatically fills in after a statement like that a phrase which in fact should not be there. And that phrase is, I say the speed of light is constant as measured by all observers, and your mind automatically fills in after, of course, you correct for the relative motion of the observer. That's not the way it goes. You do not correct for the relative motion of the observers, and you would get the wrong number if you did. Let me show you what I mean. Suppose that you are standing by a railroad track, and I am moving past you at a speed which you measure correctly. Remember, all measurements in this lecture are assumed to be made correctly into infinite precision, as 100 miles an hour. As I pass you, I take a ball and throw it forward in the direction of motion of the train at a speed which I measure with respect to the train accurately and correctly as 100 miles an hour. What speed do you accurately and correctly measure the ball as moving relative to yourself? 200 miles an hour, right? Wrong. It is not. It is, in fact, if you could measure it with infinite precision, a little tiny bit, a very tiny bit, since these numbers are so small compared to the speed of light, less than 200 miles an hour. Velocities are not additive. There is a simple formula which you can use. It's not quite as simple as V sub A plus V sub B equals V sub AB. It's not quite as simple as the velocity measured by one observer plus the velocity of that observer with respect to the other observer is the velocity as measured by the other observer. But it is a fairly simple formula, and it will give you the right answer. But it is not simple additivity. Let's take a somewhat more extreme case. Suppose that instead of going past you at a train that is going at 100 miles an hour, I go past you at a train that is moving 9/10 the speed of light. We ignore air friction. And I take a ball, they drive that way in California, so if you want to see an example of it, I take a ball and I throw it forward. Let's specify exactly what we mean. You measure the speed of the train relative to yourself as 9/10 the speed of light. I take a ball and I throw it forward on that train at a speed which I measure correctly with respect to the train as 9/10 the speed of light. You measure the speed of the ball and you not only do not get 1.8 the speed of light, you don't even get 1.0 the speed of light. You get a number which is greater than 0.9. You never add velocities and get a number that's less than one of the velocities you added, but it isn't very much greater. The reason for this is understandable if you believe in the Lorentz-Fitzgerald contraction and the time dilation. Of course, I'm trying to use it to explain them the other way around, but you know, right now you can see it if you accept that those two exist, and I've shown you experimentally they do. What's a velocity but a distance divided by a time? So many miles an hour means that it travels a certain distance in a certain length of time. And you and I disagree as to what a mile is and what a second is. So of course we get different numbers for the speed of that ball. And now we take the extreme situation. I'm moving past you at any speed you care to mention. And I throw forward not a ball, but a ray of light from a searchlight on the train. I measure its speed with respect to the train, and I get 186,000 of my miles per my second. You measure its speed with respect to the ground, and you get 186,000 of your miles per your second. Both of us get the exact same number. 186,000 miles a second. And please remember that neither of us is right or wrong in our decision, in our definition as to what a mile is and what a second is. Both of us get 186,000 miles a second, and we are both right, even though one of us is moving relative to the other. And so the best answer I can give you as to why did the Lorentz-Fitzgerald contraction and the time dilation happen is, and when you go through the formula for them, you find that, in fact, it does work out this way exactly. So that moving observers, observers moving with respect to one another, will disagree as to what a mile is and as to what a second is by exactly the right amount so that each will get the same number, 186,000 miles a second, for the speed of light. That fact, it is observed, it is checked out very well that different observers will in fact get different numbers, and that is actually what the Michelson-Morley experiment was about. What they did was they measured the velocity of light in the direction of the Earth's motion around the Sun and perpendicular to that direction, and to their amazement got the same answer. That is an observed fact of nature. That produces the Lorentz-Fitzgerald contraction and the time dilation. But if you then turn around and go to the next deeper level of why and ask me, why is the speed of light the same as measured by all observers without correcting for their relative velocity, then I have to throw up my hands and say that's the level where we've got to say we don't know. but it does happen. Let me tell you now about the third effect, and this is the one that probably makes it easiest to understand why, in quotes, you can't go faster than light. As your speed increases, I'm sorry, I take that back, as the speed of an object moving with respect to you increases, the mass of that object, that is, how heavy it is, increases. It gets heavier and heavier. And it gets heavier and heavier by the exact same amount as the numbers that I gave you earlier for the time dilation. That is to say, if it is moving at half the speed of light relative to you, it is 1.15 times as heavy as it was when it was, when you measured its mass when it was stationary with respect to you. If it is moving at 0.9 the speed of light, it is 2.29 times as heavy. So it's already twice as heavy as it reaches 87% the speed of light. If it is moving at 0.9999999999, the speed of light, that's 9 nines, it is 22,361 times as heavy. In other words, if it weighed a pound when it was stationary with respect to you, it now weighs 10 tons. And this is a real effect, and it has been observed. For example, in so-called atom smashers, which are correctly called particle accelerators, because they take subatomic particles, for example electrons, and move them around and around and around and around in a circle until they are moving at speeds very close to that of light. When you design a particle accelerator, you will find that if you don't assume that those electrons get heavier and heavier and heavier as they speed up, then your particle accelerator isn't going to work. As a matter of fact, the exact same thing happens in the cathode ray tube of your television set, the picture tube of your television set. There, too, the electrons are moving at a high speed relative to that of light, and they are a good deal heavier than if the same electrons were stationary. Now, what's the reason why, in quotes, understanding that that isn't really what we mean? Well, probably the easiest way to explain that is to quote probably the best-known formula in all of physics, and that is good old E equals mc squared. That is the formula that is so well known, every fourth grader knows it by heart. And to quote the words of Isaac Asimov, it is known to everybody from the rarefied intellectual heights of the science fiction reader down through nuclear physicists, corporation executives, housewives, busboys, all the way down to senators and congressmen. Any fourth grader can tell you what it means, and that what it means is that energy equals mass times the speed of light squared. C is the standard symbol for the speed of light. It comes from the Latin word celeritas, meaning speed. And to ask the fourth grader what that means, he will tell you that what it means is that mass M can be changed into energy E, and that furthermore, this is what happens in an atomic bomb or a hydrogen bomb, and indeed that's what happens in the center of a star and keeps it hot and therefore keeps it shining. And that if you take, you want to know how much energy you get by converting a particular amount of mass into energy, why you get it by multiplying the mass by the speed of light squared. This is true if you use the right set of units. Now, if you measure the speed of light in furlongs per fortnight, and you measure mass in stone, and you measure energy in kilowatt hours, it's not going to come out right. You know, but if you use a unified set of units, for example, speed of light in centimeters per second and mass in grams, then you will indeed get energy in ergs, and after you've got it, you stare at it, and you stare at it, and you throw it in the wastebasket because you have the foggiest notion what an erg is. But nevertheless, that's the way it works. Ergs are those things that you eat for breakfast and they give you energy, you know. The fourth grader's explanation is correct, but it's incomplete. It is true that mass can be converted into energy, and that's what happens in a hydrogen bomb and so on and so forth, but there's more to it than that. What this formula really tells you is that mass is energy and vice versa, and that the way to convert the units that you happen to use to measure mass, for example grams, into the units that you happen to use to measure energy, for example ergs, is by using this particular formula. It's nothing but a conversion formula. And furthermore, if mass is energy, energy is mass. And it really is true. I mean that literally. An object that has more energy than another object that is similar except for having less energy weighs more. A hot iron weighs more than the same iron when it's cold. A moving car weighs more than the same car when it's standing still. A flashlight battery, which is fully charged, weighs more than the same flashlight battery when you've exhausted it, and so forth and so on. Well, one of the forms of energy is kinetic energy. Kinetic energy is energy of motion, and it's certainly intuitively reasonable that a moving car has more energy, whatever energy means. I'm not defining it, but I don't have to for this lecture. Your intuitive concept of what it means is good enough. A moving car has more energy than the same car when it's holding still. And there's a simple formula will tell you the amount of kinetic energy, energy of motion, that a moving object of a particular mass and speed has. It's 1/2 the mass times the square of the velocity. Well, the moving object, therefore, has more mass than the same object when it's holding still. The two are the same. A moving car weighs more than the same car when it's holding still. Of course, the effect is very, very tiny for ordinary speed. But as you get up near the speed of light, it becomes greater and greater and greater. And so, as I mentioned, at 87% the speed of light, the moving object has as much mass due to the energy of its motion as it has due to the fact that it just had a certain amount of mass to start out with. Its rest mass is what you call the mass when it's not moving with respect to you, and that doubles at 87%. The mass at 87% of the speed of light is double the rest mass. It's the rest mass plus an amount of mass due to kinetic energy that is equal to the rest mass. And beyond 87% of the speed of light, the dominant contribution to the body's mass is actually its kinetic energy. Now, I think you can see why you can't go faster than light, in the sense that when you press that button on the rocket ship, it doesn't do the same thing. Consider, we had a button which we pressed such that it would move you from 0% the speed of light up to 10% the speed of light. And it did that by giving a certain force to the mass of the rocket, and thereby changing its speed by a certain amount. If that rocket is moving at 95% the speed of light and you press the button, the same force is exerted, but it's exerted on a very much greater mass. The rocket is much heavier simply because it's got all that kinetic energy. And so what it does is increase the speed of the rocket by very much less than it would have when you press the button at 0% the speed of light. And furthermore, the effect of that energy pushing the rocket is only partially to increase its speed. A lot of that energy goes into increasing its mass, so that the rocket is just that much heavier after you've gotten through firing the rocket than it was before, which means that if you push the button again, you will get just that much less speed increase. And if you push it again after that, you'll get just that much less, and so on. All you're doing is making the rocket heavier and heavier and heavier at a little faster each time. And in fact, if you look at the formula, you will find that to get to the speed of light would require the expenditure of an infinite amount of energy, and that at the speed of light, the rocket would have an infinite mass. There is no such thing as an infinite energy source in the universe. If there were, it would have infinite mass, and so we'd all have been sucked into it a long time ago. So I guarantee there is no such thing. And given that all energy sources in the universe are finite, you can come as close to the speed of light as you want if you are capable of expending a sufficient amount of energy to accelerate yourself up to that speed, but you cannot get to the speed of light no matter how hard you try. That's the reason, in quotes. Now, let's go fill in some of the holes. First of all, how does light manage to go at the speed of light? Well, to do that, I have to write you down the formula for each of these various increases, and it's not a terribly difficult formula, and so even those of you who are terrified of mathematics, I think I can sugarcoat this enough to make it reasonably easy. What you do to find the amount of the mass increase at a given speed and the amount of the length decrease and the amount of the time interval increase is to express the speed as a fraction of the speed of light, which remember we've been calling beta, okay? So let me remind you, if you're moving at half the speed of light, your beta is 0.5. If you're moving at the speed of light, beta is 1.0, and so on. If you're not moving at all, if you're stationary with respect to the observer who's doing the measuring, then your beta is 0. You take beta, You square it, that is, multiply it by itself. You subtract it from 1, so we've now got 1 minus beta squared. And then you take the square root of the whole mess. So you have a number which is given as the square root of 1 minus beta squared. The reason I'm reading all this out, even though you can see it on the screen, is that WKAR is taping it, and so this is for the radio listeners. Now, the mass, if you are moving at a speed of beta, is equal to the mass that you would have had when you were measured at rest with the observer who's doing the measuring, divided by the square root of 1 minus beta squared. Okay? The length that you have when you are moving at speed beta is equal to the length that you would have had moving at speed 0 with respect to the observer doing the measuring, that's called the rest length, just as m0 was the rest mass, multiplied by the square root of 1 minus beta squared. And time intervals measured by the observer on the moving object are equal to the same time interval that that observer would have measured at rest, in other words, the rest time interval, divided by the square root of 1 minus beta squared. And so, it's easy to do this if you have a calculator, and I'll give you some of the numbers. Beta 0.5, the square root of 1 minus beta squared is 0.87, and 1 over the square root of 1 minus beta squared, that's the mass increase, for example, is 1.15. If beta is 0.9, the square root of 1 minus beta squared is 0.44. Remember, I called that 44% the last time I wrote you this table. And 1 over the square root of 1 minus beta squared is equal to 2.29. And let's give you 3 nines the speed of light, 0.999. That's 0.14 and 7.1. And let's give you 5 nines the speed of light, 0.99999. Beta is 0.014. And the, where are we, 4 nines? And the mass increase is 71. And finally, let's give you 9 nines, 0.999999999. I'm glad this isn't a German audience. 0.000045 and 22,361 are the numbers that we get. All right, let's turn around now and crank her back and give you those formulae again. And I want you to tell me what's going to happen if you're moving at the speed of light. First of all, if you're moving at the speed of light, what's your beta? Everybody together. 1. Good. What's beta squared? 1. What's 1 minus beta squared? 0. What's the square root of 1 minus beta squared? 0. So your length is your rest length multiplied by 0, whatever your rest length may have been. Therefore, your length is 0, irrespective of what your length was when you started out. Your mass is your rest mass divided by 0, and that is infinity. And time intervals are time intervals divided by 0, and that means they stretch out to infinity also. Time has stopped for you. At least time has stopped for you, as seen by the observer past whom you're moving at the speed of light. Let us suppose now that you are moving at greater than the speed of light. For example, suppose you're moving at twice the speed of light. What's your beta? 2. What's beta squared? 4. What's 1 minus beta squared? Minus 3. What's the square root of 1 minus beta squared? There isn't any. There is no number which multiplied by itself gives you a negative number. Or, if you are a little more advanced in mathematics, you can say we can define so-called imaginary numbers which, when multiplied by themselves, give negative numbers. But imaginary numbers is a pretty good use for them when you get into actual physical situations like this. They don't exist. And so you see, Miss Bright, who went faster than light, would not have experienced a negative time rate, as the limerick says. She would have experienced an imaginary time rate and found out what the square root of minus 1 looks like from the inside, or the square root of minus 3, or whatever, and I shudder to think what this sort of thing would do to your health and disposition, but I can't imagine that it would necessarily be good for it. Okay, so how then does light manage to go with the speed of light? We seem to have proved very thoroughly, first by words and then by equations, that the thing is impossible. Well, let's take the mass equation, because that's probably the easiest one to see, and that was the one that I used to prove to you that you can't go faster than light to begin with. That's the one that says your mass moving at speed beta is your rest mass divided by the square root of 1 minus beta squared. And what we said was, no matter what your rest mass was, you're dividing it by zero, and so you're going to get an answer of infinity. Your mass at speed beta, beta equals 1, is going to be infinity. But there's one loophole in that. Suppose that your rest mass is zero. Then what you have is a mass for when you are traveling at the speed of light that is given by 0/0. And 0/0 is indeterminate. It can be any number that you want. For example, anything divided by itself is 1, so 0/0 must be 1. But anything divided by 0 is 0, so 0/0 is infinity, so 0/0 must be infinity. But anything divided into 0 is 0, so 0/0 must be 0, and so on. In fact, I can give you any number that you like, because, well, let's say 5 times 0 is 0. Therefore, dividing both sides by 0, 5 equals 0/0. And clearly, I could have used any number here for 5. 5 is a variable in that equation, not a constant. And so anything that you like can come out of 0/0. Now, do not despair when you run into one of those. When you run into a 0/0, in an actual physical case, what it means is that you have used an equation in a way that is inappropriate for that particular application. The equation may be fine as long as it doesn't give you a 0/0 case, but when it does, you've got to do something else. And there is an entire branch of mathematics which is devoted to how to do a 0/0 and get the right answer in a specific case. That branch of mathematics is called differential calculus. Now, I think I just startled a whole lot of people, that is, the ones who know calculus in the audience, because calculus teachers never seem to mention, you know, they never put it that way. But for those of you that know differential calculus, if you think about it for a minute, any derivative is a 0/0. And in fact, integral calculus, the other kind of calculus, is the branch of mathematics devoted to how to find the right answer when you get a case of the other big mathematical impossibility, and that's 0 times infinity. Any derivative, or any integral rather, is 0 times infinity. Okay, coming back to Earth now, for the rest of you who don't know calculus and wonder what I'm talking about, when you apply calculus to this specific situation, you find that if light has a rest mass of 0, which it does, then its mass, if it is traveling at the speed of light, at beta equals 1, is not 0 and it is not infinity. It is a number which is in between them. It is a number that is very small. And exactly what the number is depends on the wavelength of the light. Now, for those few of you who know physics, I'm going to give you what the equation is. For the rest of you, don't worry about it. Again, this is not necessary to the understanding of the lecture. But energy of anything equals mass times the speed of light squared. Therefore, mass equals energy divided by the speed of light squared. The energy of a photon, and photons are the particles that light can be thought of as consisting of. Light can be thought of in a number of ways. One of them is as a stream of subatomic particles called photons, which are just like other subatomic particles, electrons, protons, mesons, and so on, except that they have 0 rest mass. The energy of a photon, of any given photon, of light having frequency nu, is h nu. And so if that is the energy of a specific light photon, then the mass of that photon is h nu over c squared, and that is, in fact, how heavy a photon is when it is traveling. Please note, a photon has a rest mass of 0, but when it's traveling, it is not at rest. And so it does not have 0 mass. It has a mass given by this particular formula that I just wrote down. And that mass for a real case of a real light photon is very tiny, but it is not 0. You can prove that light does indeed have a mass when it is traveling. Incidentally, if it has zero rest mass, using another good old Newtonian formula, and that is Newton's second law of motion, the force required to produce a particular acceleration is equal to the mass of the object you're accelerating times the acceleration you're trying to produce, F equals ma. If the mass is zero, the rest mass is zero, then you need zero force to produce a finite acceleration, or if you give it a finite source, you get an infinite acceleration, which means that as soon as a photon is created, it accelerates instantaneously to the speed of light, and thereby keeps going to the speed of light forever. So a photon is something that not only can travel at the speed of light, it can only travel at the speed of light. It is created already going at the speed of light. And it will go at the speed of light until such time as it is destroyed by absorption in another atom, and then it instantaneously goes out of existence. Anybody, any subatomic particle, having zero rest mass, must behave the same way. There are, in fact, a number of other subatomic particles, besides the photon, which have zero rest mass, and all of them must travel at the speed of light, and in fact do. Those particles are the graviton, if it exists, which is the fundamental particle which carries gravity back and forth from one object to another, and the neutrinos, which not only exist, but are so well known to exist that there are four different kinds of them now, all of which have in common that they have no rest mass, they have no charge, but they do have a spin. They have no size, but they do have a spin. All of these bodies must travel at the speed of light. They not only can, but they must, and they are referred to collectively as luxons. Particles which have a finite rest mass, that is, it isn't zero, it's anything at all that you like greater than zero, maybe very tiny. An electron doesn't weigh very much, but it weighs more than zero. Particles that are slower than light are referred to as tardions. T-A-R-D-Y is a perfectly respectable Greek root. It means slow, just as you'd think. And on is the standard suffix that's used in subatomic physics for a particle. So tardions move at less than the speed of light. Anything which has zero rest mass and moves only at the speed of light is called a luxon, again from a Latin root this time, which means light. Okay? The mass of a photon is small, but it is not zero when it's traveling. And you can prove that by observing the fact that a beam of photons, which is to say a ray of light, that is shown onto a material object, moves that material object. It exerts a pressure. Light exerts a pressure. If I take a flashlight and I shine it onto a wall, in principle, it's a very small effect, but in principle, the wall recoils when the flashlight hits it, just as though I were spraying it with a stream of bullets from a machine gun. It would recoil more in that case because the stream of bullets is much heavier. The bullets, rather, are much heavier. And, in fact, when I turn on a flashlight, in principle, the flashlight kicks like a gun. Jerks backward a little bit. A heavy wall in the light of a little flashlight is not going to give you much of an effect, but a tiny dust grain in interplanetary space in the full light of the sun has quite a profound light pressure on it. It is, in fact, moved back from, for example, the nucleus of a comet, which may liberate it into space as that comet, which is that nucleus, which is made mostly of snow with the dust mixed into it, evaporates in the heat of the sun. And that dust is forced backwards away from the head of the comet at a speed which is typically something like 30 miles a second by the pressure of the light of the sun. And that, in fact, is what causes the dust tail of a comet, which is the one that you see most strongly with the naked eye. There's also a gas tail, which is also pushed backwards away from the sun, about 10 times as fast, in fact, by a completely different phenomenon, the solar wind. Please do not confuse the solar wind with the light pressure of the sun, and I found people very often do when they first learn of one or the other. They get them mixed up. They have nothing to do with one another. The solar wind is a material thing. It is a thin stream of gas, mostly broken down into subatomic particles, which is constantly moving away from the sun in all directions. As it passes the distance of the Earth, it is moving away from the sun at about 300 miles a second, and therefore, if there is a comet gas that is in that vicinity, it gets picked up and blown away from the head of the comet at 300 miles a second. The solar wind goes at least as far as the orbit of Uranus, which is where Pioneer 10 is, and it is still in the solar wind. Actually, Pioneer 10 has crossed the orbit of Uranus a little bit further out. We have hopes that someday Pioneer 10, Pioneer 11, or one of the Voyagers will find where the edge of the solar wind is, but it fills at least the entire solar system out to the orbit of Uranus. And it is not the same as the solar light pressure. But it so happens that the light pressure creates the gas tail of the dust tail of the comet, and the solar wind creates the gas tail of the comet, and they're separate. And they move at different speeds, in fact, for that reason. Okay, I'll give you another even more dramatic example of solar light pressure. One of the big unsung sagas in interplanetary exploration so far, all of which has been done by unmanned spacecraft. Our first successful Mars spacecraft, in fact, anybody's first successful Mars spacecraft, was Mariner 4 in 1965. And it sent back the first pictures ever taken close up of another planet. Mariner 4, as an experiment, just pretty much to see what would happen, no particular reason for it, was fitted out with vanes at the ends of the solar panels which collected the energy that powered the spacecraft from the sun. And those vanes were quite literally sails. They were set so that the sunlight bouncing off them would exert maximum pressure on them. If you would like to see a beautiful full-scale model of Mariner 4 in great detail with the vanes very clearly visible, go down to the magnificent new Michigan Space Museum, which has just opened in Jackson, and there you will see that and many, many more things. One of the finest done museums that I've ever seen, quite aside from the interest of the things that are in it. And you can see those vanes. Well, during the 8-month flight of Mariner 4 between the Earth and Mars, the spacecraft was blown 500,000 miles off the course it would otherwise have taken by the pressure of the light of the sun bouncing off those vanes. All of that was just a sort of amusing experiment and a footnote in space history until 1973, when the spacecraft Mariner 10, now very, very much more sophisticated than its predecessor, was sent first to Venus and then to Mercury. It was the first spacecraft to visit two planets in succession, and the first spacecraft ever to go to Mercury, and in fact, to this day, the one that taught us virtually all that we know about the planet Mercury. We learned almost all of what we know about Mercury in a single 4-hour period on March 29, 1973, the first flyby of Mariner 10. Well, Mariner 10, like all the Mariners, like all spacecraft, has to control its position, its orientation in space. The solar panels have got to be pointing at the sun. The antenna has got to be pointing at the Earth. The cameras have got to be pointed at Mercury if it's flying past Mercury, etc., etc. In order to control its orientation, Mariners, unlike some other spacecraft, use what is called a three-axis stabilization system, which simply means they have little gas jets which fire if the spacecraft begins to drift off the correct position and bring it back into that position. Those gas jets are controlled by, are powered by a supply of gas on the spacecraft, which is not infinite, as you can imagine, and so it is desired to fire them as little as possible and as seldom as possible so as to get you through the mission with still some gas left. Well, there is a problem on Mariner 10. The way you determine the spacecraft's orientation in space is to have one device which looks at the sun, and of course that's easy because it's so bright, another device that looks at the Earth or Venus or Mercury or whatever planet may be nearest, and that's pretty easy because they're pretty bright, but that's just two of the three dimensions in space. For the third, you must have something that is bright and in the direction roughly perpendicular to the other two, and it turns out the best object to use is the bright star Canopus. Well, even a bright star is a very faint object. I don't know if you know that the brightest star in the entire sky, which is not as bright as Canopus, in fact, only it's about twice as bright, which is brighter than Canopus. Canopus is not as bright as it. Sirius is the brightest star in the sky. And even Sirius is only 1/10 as bright as an ordinary 100-watt light bulb placed a mile from your eye. Stars are just incredibly faint objects. The only reason you can see them is that your eye has this fantastic ability to adjust its sensitivity between light and dark. And all the other stars you see are fainter than that. The faintest ones you can see are 10,000 times fainter than Sirius. Well, Canopus is a very faint object, so you need a very sensitive sensor to detect its position. Mariner 10 was the closest spacecraft to the sun up to that time, as a result of which the thermal expansion and contraction of its metal parts was the greatest that had ever been encountered. And that expansion and contraction kept flaking paint off the outside of the spacecraft. The flakes of paint would drift by the Canopus sensor and reflect the light of the sun much more brightly than Canopus itself was shining. The computer on Mariner 10 was very dumb compared to that on, say, the Viking landers or the Voyagers, which themselves are not all that bright. And every time it would see one of these flecks of paint go by, it would think that that was Canopus, and that the fact that it was moving with respect to the sensor meant the spacecraft was drifting off its Canopus reference. In other words, the spacecraft was turning in space. And so it would fire the attitude control jets to try to chase after it and keep the star oriented with respect to what it thought was Canopus. Of course, it didn't succeed because the fleck of paint was moving. And if something like this happened, it might take 10 minutes for the radio signal telling about it to travel back to the Earth at the speed of light. And nothing can go faster than that, as I've shown you. The radio signals travel at the speed of light. They're made of luxons also. They're made of photons, and photons are luxons. And then it would take another 10 minutes for the horrified command sent by the engineers on Earth to travel up to the spacecraft. Meanwhile, we'd lost 20 minutes worth of attitude control gas. That happened 3 times in the early part of the flight of Mariner 10, and the result was the attitude control gas was so depleted that there was simply not going to be enough, even if it never happened again, and the engineers could reprogram the computer a little bit to try to minimize the probability it would happen again. They'd tell it effectively, if Canopus seems to be moving, but it doesn't keep moving for half an hour, ignore it, you know, or something like that. But nevertheless, just for ordinary usage, there would not have been enough attitude control gas to get the spacecraft to Mercury even for the first flyby. And so, in desperation, the engineers at Jet Propulsion Laboratory, where the Mariners are flown, just like the Vikings and the Voyagers out in Pasadena, went back to the archive, dug out the old records of the effective light pressure on Mariner 10, and discovered that, on Mariner 4 rather, and discovered that even though Mariner 10 did not have these vanes, it was enough closer to the sun that its solar panels themselves would act as sails. And so they got their computer to tell them an orientation such that if you turn the spacecraft into this orientation with respect to the sun, the pressure of the sunlight on the different parts of the spacecraft would exert rotational motions that would cancel one another out in just such a way as to keep the spacecraft in a stable attitude in space. And it turned out, luckily, that position, although it didn't have the vanes pointed, the solar panels pointed right at the sun, nevertheless had them pointed at an angle that was close enough to being at the sun that sufficient power would be generated for the spacecraft. And it was done. For 10 months, Mariner 10 was solar sailed in its flight past Venus to Mercury, then around the sun to Mercury again, and around the sun to Mercury a third time. So that the attitude control gas was used only for the crucial period of planetary encounter when the spacecraft had to be moved around so that its cameras pointed at the planet. And the only reason that we know what we know about Mercury was that that turned out to be possible. So light definitely does have a mass. It definitely does exert a pressure when it bounces off something, and our knowledge of Mercury is the beneficiary of that. Four final things that I'd like to say. First of all, tachyons. Tachyons are hypothetical particles which always travel faster than light. Their name comes from the Greek word, from the Greek root tachys, which means fast. And so tachyon is spelled like that, T-A-C-H-Y-O-N. I seem to have shown you that even though particles which have zero rest mass can travel at the speed of light, that surely nothing could travel faster, because in the denominator of those equations down there, where you had the square root of 1 minus beta squared, if beta was greater than 1, then under that square root, you would get an imaginary number. a number that is something multiplied by I, which is the name for the imaginary square root of minus 1. Suppose, however, that you had a particle which had an imaginary rest mass. Then its rest mass would be some real number multiplied by the square root of minus 1. If it was traveling faster than the speed of light, you would then divide that imaginary rest mass by some number multiplied by the square root of minus 1. The square root of minus 1s would cancel, and you would get a real number for the mass. You say, well, now, wait a minute, come on. I mean, that's all very nice if you're playing around with mathematics, but these are supposed to be physical entities we're talking about, and how could a particle have an imaginary rest mass? Easy. We are talking about objects that can only travel faster than light, so they can never be at rest. So their rest masses are simply a mathematical fiction. They are numbers which you plug into this equation and get the right answer with, but they themselves have no real physical meaning. The only thing that has a physical meaning is the mass of the object when it is actually traveling. And so tachyons would be particles which have imaginary rest masses, just as tardions had real rest masses and luxons had zero rest masses. Tardions can travel only below the speed of light, luxons only at the speed of light, and tachyons could travel only faster than the speed of light. If they are created by whatever processes create them, and subatomic particles can be created out of energy, remember E equals mc squared, why, they would be created at a speed that is already greater than that of light, just as a tardion would be created at a speed that is less than that. The lowest energy tachyons would be particles traveling at infinite speeds. And as you gave them more and more energies, they would slow down, getting closer and closer to the speed of light, and it would take infinite energy to slow them down to the speed of light, just as on the other side, it would have taken infinite energy to speed up a tardion to the speed of light. There are problems with the existence of tachyons. For example, a tachyon would be traveling, if it had these properties, it can be shown mathematically, that a tachyon would have to be traveling backwards through time. However, it turns out that's not as big a problem as you thought, because it can also be shown mathematically that a tachyon traveling backwards through time with, say, a positive electric charge would be observed in all possible respects that you could observe a subatomic particle in exactly the same way as a normal particle with the opposite charge traveling forward through time. That is called the reinterpretation principle, and it seems to get rid of the problem with direction of travel in time. Besides which, what is so special about the direction that we travel in time? There is nothing particularly there's nothing particularly obvious about the difference between the past and the future. What matters is that there seems to be a uniform direction of flow, and there is no law that says there couldn't be other particles which are flowing in the opposite direction all the time. I hope you see why I call this lecture "Why You Can't Go Faster Than Light." Because whether tachyons exist or not, you are not made of them. You are made of tardions, and tardions cannot be even speeded up to the speed of light, let alone go beyond it. The only way that you could travel faster than light would be if you were made of tachyons and had been ever since all of the subatomic particles that you are made of came into existence. And if that were so, then you could never slow down to the speed of light, and undoubtedly would be just as annoyed by that as you are, in fact, by not being able to get up to it. Believe it or not, the mere fact that a tachyon would be something that would travel faster than light and would have, therefore, an imaginary rest mass can be used to derive mathematically enough of its properties that you can actually begin to design a search project to look for it. That's a standard sort of thing in subatomic physics. You just state a few properties that a particle might have, and a lot of other properties come falling out of that. Searches have been made for tachyons. So far, they have been uniformly negative. No evidence that tachyons exist has been found. That does not mean that they don't exist. It simply may mean that we are looking for tachyons of too low energy, that most of the ones that exist are traveling at speeds that are relatively low as tachyons go. Remember, that means high energy for a tachyon. It could also mean that we have simply been working in the wrong places or at the wrong times or in the wrong ways or the wrong this, that, or the other thing. The neutrino, which definitely exists, in fact there are four different kinds of them, was theoretically postulated and pretty well proved that it had to exist 30 years before one of them was found. And they very definitely do exist. But the fact that the equations do not seem to rule out the existence of tachyons is itself persuasive evidence that they exist. There seems to be a general rule in subatomic physics that it's a perfect dictatorship. Anything that is not forbidden is compulsory. There is no choice. Anything the equations don't rule out, sooner or later, has been shown actually to exist. And there have been a number of breakthroughs in the progress of subatomic physics, which have been done simply by applying that. And so back in the 30s, Dirac realized that there was nothing in the equations that said that a particle, just like an electron only positively charged, whereas electrons are negatively charged, could not exist, and so he looked and eventually found the positron. That's just one example out of many. If it can be shown that tachyons do not exist, then what that tells us is something important. This is one of the many cases in fundamental research where a negative result is just as important as a positive. That is, we've got to write another equation which doesn't allow them to exist, and at present it doesn't seem very obvious what that would be. If they do exist, of course, then there's just one more weird thing in the universe, and there are tachyons, and they always travel faster than light, but that gives no hope to the likes of us who are made of tardions and cannot get up to it. Light, which is traveling through a substance, does not travel at 186,000 miles a second. A substance that a light can travel through is generally referred to as a medium in optics, and medium is one of those tricky words that everybody uses in different ways. It's a singular, and the plural is media. I wish I had a nickel for everybody that I have heard saying the news media is thus and so. If I did, I would have enough money to make stick-on labels to plastic. The speed of light that is traveling through glass or water is only about two-thirds of the speed of light in a vacuum, and there are some media in which it goes down to about half of the speed of light in a vacuum. As a matter of fact, for reasons that it would take far too long to explain here, the only reason that lenses work and prisms and most of optics, in fact, everything but reflective optics, is the fact that light slows down when it's traveling through a medium. But the reason that I wanted to mention that fact here is that it is possible, since light does not travel at, quote, the speed of light, when it's in a medium. See, the phrase the speed of light, which actually means the speed of any subatomic particles with zero rest mass, and includes all electromagnetic radiation, infrared, ultraviolet, X-rays, gamma rays, radio waves, as well as light. That means the speed of light or those other electromagnetic radiations in a vacuum, and that is the magic number, 186,282.3960 miles per second, which all observers will get no matter what their relative motion to each other. Light slows down in a medium, and that means that it is possible to have other subatomic particles, for example, electrons, travel through a medium at a speed that is faster than the speed of light in that medium. Not faster than the speed of light in a vacuum, but you can send electrons through glass or air at a speed that is greater than the speed of light in glass or air. When they do that, there is an effect. They are slowed down as they travel through the medium, and their energy is converted into a form of radiation. It can be light, it can be radio waves, depends on circumstances. If it's light, it's often a beautiful blue glow, which you can see in a swimming pool reactor, for example, which is called Cherenkov radiation, after the Russian physicist who first explained it. And every once in a while, somebody who has heard that you can't go faster than light, but doesn't really believe it, or at least doesn't know why, reads about Cherenkov radiation, which is produced by particles that are moving faster than the speed of light in a medium, and gets very excited because they miss the significance of that phrase, in a medium, and think that it's been shown somehow that you can go faster than the speed of light in a vacuum. Not so. Point number three, why the speed of light has the value that it does is a very interesting question and a separate question from the so far unanswerable question why, that is, why does the speed of light always behave as a constant for any observer? This, in fact, is just a class of a very interesting problem, one of the basic problems in physics, and yet one that is virtually never mentioned in elementary physics courses. And I think that's a shame, because it's something that anybody can understand, and it's a really interesting question. We don't know why it is that the particular physical laws that govern the universe, as opposed to some other physical laws, are the way they are instead of some other way. Why is the equation for gravity F equals G times the one mass times the other mass divided by the square of the radius? You know, why isn't the cube of the radius, or just the radius itself, or something? That's one question, and we don't know the answer. But given that it is the case that that is the right form for the law of gravity, there is a separate question, and that is, why is the constant in that equation, the G, which tells you how strong a given gravitational field will be, you know, given a particular mass and a particular other mass and a particular distance between their centers, you must multiply all that by this constant G to get the value of the force. Why does G have the particular value that it does instead of some other value? Given that the law of nature is that all subatomic particles have the same charge, either plus or minus the charge on the electron, which is a law of nature that we do not understand why, but given that that's the case, why is the charge on the electron the particular value that it is instead of some other value? Why isn't it 10,000 times as great as that? And given that the speed of light in a vacuum has all these properties that I've told you about, including that it is the same as measured by all observers, why is it the particular value that it is? Why 186,000 miles a second? Why isn't it 10 times as big as that? Why isn't it 60 miles an hour? Why isn't it 5 billion miles a second? Why is it the value that it is? And that we do not know the answer to, and it seems as though finding that out is a separate question to finding out why the laws are the way they are. All the laws of physics involve a particular set of constants, and there are about half a dozen of them that are independent of one another. The others can be derived from those half dozen. There is the speed of light, there is the ratio of the charge to the mass of an electron, there is the something called Planck's constant, well, there's the gravitational constant, there are one or two others. And you can look up their numbers in any physics book, usually it's right there in the front, tabulated for easy reference, because you use them all the time in a physics course. But why do they have those particular values? The universe would be very, very different if those numbers were different. If the speed of light were 60 miles an hour, and you could see all these effects in everyday life, I think it's obvious to you the universe would be very different. If the fine structure constant, which is another of those basic numbers, and which is 1 over 137, has to do with certain subatomic physics, were just slightly different from the way it is, then there would be certain nuclear reactions which wouldn't go the way that they do in such a direction that carbon would not have been created in large quantities inside the stars that created it before the solar system existed. Those stars then blew up and contaminated the gas cloud from which the solar system was formed. And carbon would be very rare in the solar system, and we would not be here because we are based on carbon. Wolfgang Pauli said, God made the fine structure constant 1 over 137 so the creatures would arise to worship him. It's as good an explanation as any. Why is it 1 over 137? We don't know the answer to that. Final point, the fact that you cannot go faster than light is one that is ignored in virtually all science fiction about interstellar spaceflight. And Tau Zero, as a matter of fact, by Paul Anderson, as a matter of fact, is one of the very few science fiction novels that have been written that run into that head on and take some of the implications and accept them, and I think it's very interesting for that reason. Though even Anderson, in most of his science fiction, just postulates, as most of the science fiction authors have done, that somehow some loophole will be found, that the physics that I've told you, although correct, I mean, it's been checked out very thoroughly, is incomplete. In the same way as Newton's laws turned out to be incomplete. They were approximations that were true only at speeds slow compared to that of light. And somehow some loophole will be found and you'll be able to travel faster than light. Well, I can never prove that such a loophole won't be found, but I think it's very unlikely. For one thing, people have been trying an awfully long time and they haven't been able to do it. And remember, most of the activity in physics has gone on in the last 20 years or so. So the fact that it may have taken centuries to disprove Newton doesn't mean that it would take centuries to do it now. I think that it's unlikely that we're going to be able to go faster than light, and I think furthermore that if we are not, it is going to lead to a situation that is much more interesting than the universe assumed by most of the science fiction writers, in which you can and therefore can go from any point to any other point in a very short period of time, say a few days or a few weeks. That kind of universe is simply a bigger Earth. It's just a bigger version of the global village that we are developing on this planet, where, to a very large extent, the entire culture is homogeneous. And so you have things like Star Wars, which assumes that you will be able to go faster than light. Those spacecraft go much faster than light, obviously. They go from star to star in just days, and everybody isn't a great deal older when you get there, you know. So it's not that we're just seeing a relativistic time contraction on the people involved. It assumes there's some way to go faster than light. In fact, in their own typically Turkey-ish way, the scriptwriters of Star Wars attempt to indicate that by having the captain of the spaceship say that his spaceship can go from such and such a place to such and such another place, which is very distant, in only a few parsecs. Apparently some idiot in the scriptwriting staff thinks that parsec is a unit of time. It is not. It is a unit of distance. But nevertheless, you know, they're trying to get it across to you there. They're not succeeding very well. I think it's a very uninteresting kind of universe. I mean, we've already got it on the Earth. And why go any further if that's all we're going to have? I mean, why just have a bigger version of what we already have on this planet? In fact, I think we're going to have a very different situation. Within a few centuries, we are going to go out to the other stars. I don't think there's any question about that. I can't tell you in detail how to do it any more than in 1930 I could have told you in detail how to go to the moon. But it was already clear in 1930 that you could go to the moon, and that the way to do it was by rockets rather than, for example, by hot air balloons. And after that, it was simply a matter of engineering. Now, I say simply, and of course an engineer would kill me for that, because the engineering difficulties were enormous. But it was obvious, or at least it should have been obvious, of course to most people it wasn't, but it was obvious that the engineering difficulties, given enough time and money and interest, could be worked out, and that we knew how to go to the moon in that sense in 1930. In this sense, we know how to get to the stars in 1977. You're going to have to use a rocket, a method of propulsion that is much more efficient than the chemical rockets we use today. Such methods are known, for example, or possibly fusion power, but I can't claim that's known. But there are things like ion drives, using very efficient nuclear methods to get the energy, a number of other possibilities. All you got to do is accelerate at 1G for 1 year, and you're practically at the speed of light. So it's nothing at all terribly difficult, and then you enjoy your own weight, you know, your Earth weight during the entire acceleration, and you do it for 1 year. Well, that takes a tremendous amount of fuel if you use our present chemical rockets. But to quote Arthur C. Clarke, I have seen most of the proofs that near-light speeds are impossible to achieve with present technology, and they are all basically equivalent to showing the dirigible cannot break the sound barrier. You need a different gadget, and there are several such gadgets on the board. We will build interstellar spaceships. I suspect we will build them in the lifetime of most of the people in this room, or at least we'll be able to build them. Whether we'll be allowed to build them is a separate question, which is outside the scope of this lecture. That is to say, it's theological. Political, which is the same difference. I think it will be done, and I think that as soon as it will become possible to be done, people will want to do it. But you've got a very interesting situation here. If you have sufficiently efficient energy sources, you can go at any reasonable speed close to that of light. You could go from here to the Andromeda Galaxy and back in an afternoon of your time. But when you got back home, you would find that 5 million years had gone by. Several ice ages had come and gone. Evolution had probably changed your entire species, if it hadn't destroyed it, changed it to something you would not even recognize. Let's take a less severe case. Suppose you go to the star Deneb, 1,600 light years away. That means A light year is a unit of distance, not of time, and that means that it takes light 1,600 years to travel from Deneb to the Earth, or vice versa. Which means, by the way, you're seeing Deneb not as it is tonight, but as it was in the year 400, 1,600 years ago. If you want to know what it looks like tonight, you have to wait 1,600 years. I assure you it looks the same, but, you know, in principle, you're seeing these objects as they were centuries ago. If you went to Deneb and back, you could do it in a second, if you had enough energy. But when you came back, you would find that 3,200 years had elapsed on the Earth. Vega, 27 light years away, is about as far as you could go and return and still hope to see again the people that you knew when you had left. You knew them as children when you had left, and they would be relatively old people when you got back. And beyond Vega, this is a haunting phrase due to Arthur C. Clarke, no man will ever return from beyond Vega and greet again those he knew on the Earth when he had left. What this means is that there will be interstellar voyages. I think there will be interstellar colonization. And even if there are not planets that are suitable around other stars, and I suspect that Earth-type planets or any other type of planets are very, very rare, because there's such variety among the planets in their own solar system. There are any two that are like one another, and there's certainly not another that's like the Earth. But it doesn't matter. We will be building space colonies in our own solar system in the next few decades out of asteroidal material, out of low-gravity environment material, and I'm sure there will be such bodies around other stars as well. We'll be able to pick and choose, build our own artificial worlds when we get there. Indeed, the space colonies themselves will presumably become the interstellar spacecraft, some of them. And I think that there will be reasons to do it, because the nature of humans is such that some humans disagree with other humans strongly enough to want to get away from them. I can't tell you in detail why we will colonize other stars any more than Columbus could have told you in detail all the myriad reasons that turned out to be for the colonization of America once it became technologically possible. But I think that it will be done. But all of these voyages will be one way. There will be no reason to return. If you return from a star, say, 200 light years away, 400 years would have gone by on Earth, and the culture you return to would be as alien to you as any that you might have gone to in some other direction. I'm sure there will be voyages back and forth very occasionally for very, very strong reasons. But the idea of an interstellar war is ridiculous. Would we fight a war with the ancient Romans? What do they have that we could want so badly as to wait for hundreds of years to get it? And I think furthermore that, no, but I mean, what would they have that we couldn't get cheaply, more cheaply some other way? You know, quite aside from waiting all that time for it. And even more than that, what this means is you're going to have a return to a situation which has been the norm for humanity throughout all of history up until the present about half century. And that is no global village. Take a Roman times. You had the Romans with a high culture. You had the Chinese at the same time with a high culture and absolutely no idea of what each other were doing. And in Mesoamerica, yet another one, with no interchange whatsoever. And each of them very, very different. So you had a great deal of cultural diversity. I think we're going to be seeing the same thing within another few centuries. As the human race spreads out from star to star within the galaxy, whether or not there are other intelligent races out there being a separate question, I'm sure there's enough real estate to go around. And as we spread out, we will find within a few centuries that the human race consists of a large number of independent cultures, each going its own way, with only the haziest notion of what each other is doing, and the most recent information of each one about each other one, hundreds or even thousands of years out of date. As though the most recent information we had from the Mediterranean was that the Roman Empire had just fallen. That's the equivalent of our information about the colony around Deneb. I think it's a very interesting situation. I think that is a challenge for science fiction writers. And I can only think of one story offhand among the science fiction I've read, which is not all that universal, which has met that challenge head on. It is a story by Arthur C. Clarke called The Songs of Distant Earth. I would like to see more of it done. You got another example? The Forever War, Joe Haldeman? Good. I can think of a couple of cases where...
Well, not Childhood Den, and several other cases like Earth of Rome, and stories and so forth, but there you're restricting yourself to just a few stars that are relatively close by, you know, a few tens of light years apart at most,
and so you don't get the full implications of it. Decades is important. A very haunting story by Ursula Le Guin, Semele's Necklace, about what a time lapse, a time rate difference of a few decades could do to a person who was not expecting it, who did not know that it was going to happen. A person from a primitive culture who had this happen to her, she said she wanted it because she didn't know what she was getting into. And it's a very haunting story, but it's not the full implication. That's not the same as the time rate difference of centuries or millennia or even more. And then, of course, before very much longer in astronomical time scales, you will have separate evolutionary tracks going their different ways. And so whether or not there are different intelligent species out there now, there are going to be within 500,000 years or so, all with a single common ancestor, ourselves, but I'm sure very different from one another. It's an interesting thought. I think it's a good way to end the lecture. Thank you. Thank you very much. That was a mere 3 hours. I'm evidently getting more concise. I'll be most happy to take any questions you have, but I'd like to take them from the floor for two reasons. Number one, if we don't do it that way, 16 people all come up and ask me the same question. I have to keep answering it over and over again. Number two, our good people at WKAR are recording this, and so they would like you to speak into the microphones that you see around the room. Here's one, two back there, another one here on the table. There's yet another one, a whole bunch of microphones. Any of them will get picked up, but please do speak into those. Let's give those who do want to leave a chance to do so, and then we'll take questions. By the way, if you're leaving, please, or even if you aren't, please remember, if you don't have a copy of these schedules here, take them, lots of other good topics. One every month. And take some for your friends, too, please. Anybody that you know will be interested.
You ready for this?
Oh, just about. Let's give them another couple seconds. Couple tens of seconds. Okay, question right there.
Say we have triplets. Curly, Larry, and Moe.
All right.
Curly goes off in one direction from the Earth, and Moe goes off in the opposite direction.
Okay.
They then come back to Earth, but Moe... I see. Curly sees Moe go off with an acceleration. Yeah.
Right.
And Moe sees Curly go off with an acceleration, mm-hmm. and Curly sees Moe go off with the opposite acceleration,
okay.
right? What do they say about each other's age when they come back to Earth?
If Curly and Moe both had exactly symmetrical flight paths, same acceleration pattern, same speeds for the same length of time and so forth, when they come back, they will be the same age as each other, and the person who stayed behind on the Earth will be considerably older than either of them. If they had different acceleration patterns, then it becomes more complicated, and there's no simple answer. It's a matter of, you know, who spent the more time at the higher speed, who was younger.
You're answering simply from symmetry, you know. That's all right. But I'm saying, what about Moe? Doesn't Moe want to say that Curly... Doesn't Moe want to say that... Okay, yeah. Okay, he doesn't say stationary because he can measure an acceleration.
That's right. That's right. See, as soon as you introduce accelerations, you make these nice simple formulas that I've drawn for you with the square root of 1 minus a squared is much more complicated.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Photons have a zero rest mass, you said, and so I'm curious how something with a zero rest mass, therefore zero mass, can then have mass. That's like having mass from no mass, which, you know, which violates the first.
Traveling at the speed of light, because at the speed of light you multiply the rest mass of any object by infinity. So you're taking zero times infinity and you're getting an answer, and it turns out when you go through the appropriate mathematics to get that answer, it has a mass, and that mass is h nu over c squared. Where h is a Planck constant, nu is the speed of light, as the frequency, and c is the speed of light. Okay.
Well, I still don't understand. If zero mass means no mass,
no,
then you're...
zero mass doesn't mean no mass in the sense you're talking about. The difference between zero and nothing, you know. I'll illustrate it to you. No, there is. There really is. Yeah. I'll illustrate it to you. Suppose a genie appears from a bottle and gives you your choice of either of the two following things. Number one, complete and total happiness for the rest of your life. Number two, a ham sandwich. Which should you pick? The answer is a ham sandwich, because nothing is better than complete and total happiness for the rest of your life, and a ham sandwich is better than nothing. Question over here.
Let us take Curly and Mo traveling toward one another at light speed.
Can't.
At close to light speed.
Okay.
They pass at close proximity and then pass away from each other,
mm-hmm.
each at 0.9 light speed.
All right, so... like so, correct?
What is their speed relative to one another after they have just passed?
Their speed relative to one another is not additive. Okay? If this one, I think what you're trying to ask is a question that people often do, and that is, if we're here on the Earth and somebody is moving at 0.9 the speed of light with respect to us on one side, and somebody else is moving at 0.9 the speed of light in the opposite direction with respect to us on the other side, surely the one measures the speed of the other with respect to him as 1.8 the speed of light. And he doesn't, because speeds are not additive. Velocities are not additive. Is that the question you're asking, or am I missing it?
After they have passed each other,
okay.
going away from each other, each at...
each at 0.9 the speed of light relative to somebody in the middle?
Relative to the other one.
Well, you're specifying you're moving 0.9 the speed of light relative to each other, then I'll make my problem easy. Because the answer to your question is, they're moving at 0.9 relative to the speed of each other.
Yeah.
Relative to each other. Okay.
But if each one is moving at 0.9 the speed of light relative to a stationary object,
okay,
and then they pass...
okay.
each other.
Yeah.
It's not additive then still.
It is not additive then still. What will happen in the earlier case where they're moving towards each other is that the velocity with which Curly sees Mo moving towards him is less than the sum of the velocity with which the Earth observer sees Mo moving towards him plus the velocity with which the Earth observer sees Curly moving towards him. At the later case, the speed with which Curly sees Mo moving away from him will be less than the sum of the speed with which the Earth observer sees Curly moving away from him plus the speed with which the Earth observer sees Mo moving away from him. In either case, the velocity is additive. In both cases, Curly's and Mo's apprehension of their respective velocities with respect to each other is less than the sum of the Earth observer's apprehension of their respective velocities with respect to the Earth.
Okay.
Okay. It might help if I wrote the formula for having a velocity, but I doubt it, and since I don't remember it, I won't.
Can you see the
tail? Yes, but they'll be jobless. Over there.
You talked about a photon being a luxon and only existing at the speed of light, correct?
Right.
How can a photon exist going through a medium if it is going slower than the speed of light? Does it not exist?
That's a very good question. Yes, it exists. Did everybody hear that? How can a photon exist if it's going through a medium if it is traveling less than the speed of light and it has to travel the speed of light to be a luxon? I'm sorry, there's just no simple answer to that. When you go through the mathematics, it turns out it can. For one thing, I didn't introduce the distinction. It's better to think of it there as a wave. And there is a distinction between phase velocity and group velocity, which I didn't want to try to get into.
But it turns out
one of them is still the speed of light in a vacuum, and that makes it all right. And yet, the other one is not the speed of light in a vacuum, and that has the effects that are responsible, for example, the way lenses operate. That is a very, very hairy one. There is just no simple explanation I can give you. And I realize that is a cop-out, but it's the only thing that I can do. I'm sorry, that's a very, very good question. I hate to do this, but I've got you. Over there.
I hate to do this, but maybe this will be a bit unfair to ask you, too, because this is a question I've asked my physics professors, and they don't give me a really satisfactory answer, but I figured you'd be the person to ask, I guess, if anyone. The question is...
I agree.
Okay. All right, well, the question is this. Electron spin is supposed to be attributed to a relativistic effect. But you try to corner one of the profs with this question, and they'll just say, well, it's relativity. And, you know, I feel I've got a fundamental grasp of what you've been saying tonight, but I don't see how it can relate to electron spin at all. So,
electron spin?
Right.
I'm not sure exactly what you're getting at. You say electron spin is a relativistic effect.
Well,
I would say the effects of relativistic of electron spin, for example, magnetism, are relativistic effects. That's a different statement.
And magnetism is also a relativistic effect.
Yes, but I mean the spin is just, you know, it sits there and it spins. Which is a little hard to visualize since it has zero diameter, but nevertheless it achieves it. What that boils down to is the thing that you call spin with a billiard ball, which is more easy to understand, reduces to a property which an electron has and which we still call spin for simplicity, but an electron does not behave like a billiard ball. Subatomic particles do not behave in the same way as, in all ways, in the same way as macroscopic particles do. But that's not the answer to your question, I don't think. It's just a warning that English doesn't always mean the same thing. You know, it's like asking what's the color of a proton. It's a meaningless question because color is a phenomenon of the wavelength of light, and the proton is considerably smaller than even a single light wavelength, and you can't see a proton by bouncing light off it the way you can see a billiard ball by bouncing light off it, so it's simply not a question that you can answer. I think your problem is probably the same order of difficulty, but I'm not really clear just what you're getting at. You're shaking your head just without answering your question. I have a feeling I'm not.
Well, I think you're reformulating it in a way,
okay.
and maybe my question didn't make any sense. All I know is
I suspect it literally didn't make any sense in the sense that, not that it was a bad question, but in the sense that you were asking a question using undefinable terms.
Well, what I was afraid of is that electron spin requires an acceleration, and special relativity does not deal with acceleration like you've been talking about.
It's just much more complicated for me.
Well, if you take a point on the electron and you have that
traveling,
all right, and every point on that electron can be regarded, if the electron is spinning, as having a circular path around.
No, I can't, because the electron is itself a point. And I think that's
no. Well, you talked about the electron like a zero diameter, but
yes. But
how can you do that?
I think that's a very good question.
Because it does.
I think that's a very good question to which falls into the category of ones that can be used to the level that I have to say we don't know. They achieve it. The experimental evidence, even the biggest, the diameter of the electron is literally zero. You want to think of the electron as a black hole, but only half of that is it, but people always do when they get to this point.
All right. Just something to mention. I think in what I've encountered in my reading, worthless as this might be, you can consider the electron as a wave, which means that you might not be able to define it as having a diameter. But at the same time, you can't pinpoint that it has a particular diameter. It's just sort of undefined.
Yeah, particles, I'm using the term for convenience, have particle characteristics under some circumstances and wave characteristics in others. The electron, I think it's very fair to answer that one. The electron is not itself a wave. There is a phenomenon
which has the mathematical characteristics of a wave, that is, you use the same equations, which describe the probability of finding the electron in a specific location if you look at a specific occasion. So the wave is a probability wave having to do with where the electron is, rather than the something describing the size of the electron. Okay? Is that a reasonable way of looking at it?
That's an alternative, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, the size of you is separate from the fact that you are located somewhere in this room. That's a much larger size range. Okay, to take a macroscopic